The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
The story goes that just before World War I, German Emperor William II met the president of Switzerland, and he asked him how many troops the Swiss had. And the president answered, they had 150,000 men. And William then said, well, what if I were to invade you with 300,000 men? And the president answered, that means each of us will have to shoot twice. Now, smaller numbers have never been a problem when attitude and strategy are right. And many would argue that in various countries in the 19th century, when secularization came, the church was uncoupled from its position of political power, but rather than having less influence on the surrounding culture, it actually had more. Sociologists talk about the marginalization of the church in the 19th century. And the margin is a key place. When I read a book, I can interact vigorously with the text when the margin is large enough to write my comments. And often, a smaller group that really means business is more effective than an awkward giant. But what about the 20th century? What exactly is the case for the church in America today? Is the church happily in the margin, prophetically interacting with the text of our families, our cities, and our culture? Or is the church being marginalized away from a position of influence? Is the church's influence being felt, or is it in decline, as this topic suggests? Now, these questions are hard to answer objectively. In order to establish whether the church is in decline, you need to know what the church's impact was to begin with. Was it robust and more effective generations ago? We all have such strong feelings about what we perceive the church's impact to have been and what it is now, and we're afraid that things are happening in our culture that we can't control. But what's the truth of the matter? During the 1980s, many Christians believed that our country had been founded on Christian principles, and that since that time, there has been serious decline. We had been a Christian nation, but now we're losing that character and are coming dangerously close to barbarism. An appeal was made to our Christian forefathers and to the American Revolution. However, studies such as the Search for Christian America showed us that things were not that simple. Though many Christian values were among the influences in the days of the Founding Fathers, not only were there also non-Christian ones, particularly from the deists, but also grave gaps on the Christian side. And though the Puritans were remarkable Christians, they were nevertheless often blind, for example, to the rights of Native Americans. They confused church and state, limiting public office and even voting to church members. And the contradiction between the ideals of the American Revolution and, for example, the treatment of blacks is another type of blindness. And so the Golden Age never was. Measuring decline or progress is very difficult. And I think it's a human tendency to believe that things were better in the old days. I catch myself telling students at Westminster that in my day, we had a lot more reading than they did, far more papers and so on. And I carefully forget that I was on a student committee at the time to push for a reduced workload. Now, as we look at our topic, we want to avoid two errors. The French author Bernanos once said that the only difference between an optimist and a pessimist is the optimist is a fool who's happy, and the pessimist is a fool who is unhappy. Well, we don't want to be either optimists or pessimists. We want to be what I would call realists with hope. Realists because we want to be honest about the facts. And hope because our Lord promised that he would build the church and that the gates of hell would not prevail against it. But getting hold of the facts and then presenting a strategy is not as easy as it might appear. Let's begin with some basic facts about the church in America. And then we'll look at those three areas in the topic, family, city, and culture. And within those categories, I'd like to spell out what I believe to be healthy and unhealthy trends. In other words, the good news and the bad news. And finally, some conclusions about what can be done. A lot of people around the world look with envy at the high profile of the church in America. There's been considerable surprise at the fact that America is the world's most advanced industrial country with the highest degree of pluralism found anywhere, and yet it's one of the most overtly religious countries to be found. When I was growing up in the 60s, people used to predict that the church would disappear because we were in such a technical, secularized and urbanized culture. On the contrary, church attendance in America has remained at the same high level for over 50 years. Now, the furniture has been moved around considerably. In 1937, church attendance was 41%. Then it dipped to its lowest point, 37%, in 1940. Things picked up again in the 50s, with percentages in the high 40s. Then some decline in the 60s, mostly because of the all-time low church attendance by Roman Catholics. But soon after, attendance went back up. And then everything remained steady right to the present at 42%. Since the late 60s, 4 Americans in 10 have been going to church at least once a week. The total attendance, therefore, is the same as in the 30s, but important shifts have taken place. The greatest decline in church attendance is in the mainline Protestant churches. Since 1965, the United Methodist Church dropped from 11 million to 9.2 million. The Presbyterian Church, U.S., went from 4 to 3 million. The Episcopal Church from 3.4 to 2.5 million. The three largest Lutheran branches lost over 500,000. Now, up until the 50s, the growth in these mainline churches had been either better than or equal to the population. In the 60s, it slowed down, and then beginning in the 70s, there were losses. And by 1990, we have a 20th century low. These are dramatic figures. They spell a massive loss in the mainline denominations. But there are patterns that offset this one. The Roman Catholic Church has come back from its losses in the 60s to a flat growth pattern. But the most important counter trend is the surge in alternative religious attendance. The evangelical movement, the various charismatic movements, and the general rise of conservative groups outside the main line has pushed attendance figures back to the overall norm. Since 1965, evangelicals have grown 8% every 5 years. 40 million Americans claim to be evangelical Christians today in America. Denominations like Southern Baptists, the Assemblies of God, and the Seventh-day Adventists have posted very significant growth figures. Now, these are very encouraging figures on the surface of it. It would appear that we could say the old land groups may be dying out, but they're being replaced by newer, more dynamic movements. Old wineskins have become obsolete. The new wine can only be contained in the new wineskins. And many groups are even claiming that religious revival is going on. Indeed, growing up, as I said, in the 60s, it was our impression that Christianity would probably die out altogether, not with a bang but a whimper. And what a shock it was to discover that not only was Christianity alive, but evangelical Christianity was to have a tremendous comeback. And as you know, Newsweek in 1976 dubbed it the year of the evangelical. On the surface, then, it looks as though there ought to be significant impact on the family, the church, and our culture. Not only are the numbers steady, but there's new life in many quarters. But now here comes a haunting question. If the numbers are the same, and indeed if there's religious revival going on in the judgment of some, do we in fact see a significant influence on the family, the city, or the culture? Again, my plea is for realism with hope. Let's look at these three categories. It's well known that the family is being severely tried today. The traditional nuclear family, consisting of a husband who goes out to work, a wife who raises two or more children, is rapidly giving way to other patterns. In 1950, over half of all Americans belonged to a nuclear family. Today, only 10% do. In many families, both husband and wife are employed. Married couples with or without children today represent only 60% of U.S. households. One in four families are headed by single parents. In 1990, one of every 15 children was born out of wedlock. 8 million seniors live alone. Close to 3 million households are made up of unmarried couples. If the trend continues, that will go down to 53% by the year 2000. Now, first, the good news. Many churches are taking these trends into account and finding very creative ways to work with them. To give a couple of examples, churches are questioning the exclusivity of the nuclear family model. Not only is this not the way many families are structured today, but the Bible does not limit us to that particular type. Rather, the prevailing type, both in the Old and in the New Testament, is the residential extended family, where members are not limited to strict biological ties. And so rather than channeling all of its ministry to the ideal type of the nuclear family, many churches are targeting a larger group. Another example. Some churches have begun to look hard at the demographics of America in the 1990s. They've noted, for example, that while for a time the baby boomers left the church, by no means did all baby boomers stay away. 40% stayed out, a third never left, and another third came back. Younger boomers are willing to come back to traditional organized religion. Older boomers, those shaped by the civil rights movement, tend to be more liberal, but will come back to alternative religious forms. In any case, various churches are adjusting their worship styles, their theological emphases, and their congregational life to the needs of this powerful group. A parallel but somewhat different adjustment is being made to accommodate the so-called baby busters, that is, those born in the period after 1964, when birth rates collapsed to half of what they had been. Noting that this generation is often a victim of divorce, particularly prone to instant gratification, though also fearful of prevalent violence, addiction, and AIDS, the churches have begun to build programs around the need for recovery and healing that suits the needs of these people. Alert churches are helping the busters live in the real world while yet resisting the materialism of their yuppie forebears. Now for the bad news. The trends in family life involve much more than readjusting from nuclear to extended patterning. They involve severe threats to the very fact of the family. And because this is not clearly understood, there are many opportunities which are being met with good intentions, but not with good results. For example, a Los Angeles Times poll found in 1990 that of the 65% of couples with both spouses employed, the majority of parents care profoundly about family life. For 80% of men, family and children were more important than work, career, or leisure time. Yet there's little evidence that parents, especially fathers, are able to live up to those ideals. One gap in this same survey showed a very small amount of time was given to family activities. Teenagers spend less than 30 minutes per week with their fathers. The largest gap was church going. While a good number of parents said that it was important to go to church, only 48% actually do. Another gap comes close to home for us. In a recent Christianity Today study, 9 out of 10 evangelical Christians say they accept the changing gender roles that go with the two-career trend. That is, spouses should shoulder the responsibility of raising the children equally. But in fact, only modest shifts have occurred when the wife works full-time. She usually has to add to her duties, whereas the husband does token jobs. And this reflects the national pattern. According to the 1990 Census Bureau report, 30% of preschoolers are cared for at home by someone other than their mother, half by the father, over a quarter by a relative, and a fifth by caretakers. It's disappointing, to say the least, that Christians are not on the frontier of this need. Many more patterns in family life spell missed opportunities for the church. Divorce rates have more than doubled since the 50s. A University of Wisconsin team has predicted that 2 out of every 3 currently married couples will end in divorce. Many are also headed towards serial monogamy, that is, term marriages. By the end of the century, 13 million households will be run by single parents. Generalizations should be cautioned against. A number of single-parent families are doing very well. But various studies show serious problems in a good number of them, particularly with the children. These include learning difficulties, withdrawal, and stress. Because of the large number of single families suffering from poverty, problems are more serious where parents are low down on the income level. Now, I have a lot of other statistics here which I will spare you. There's a reason to rejoice and a reason to be concerned. The call of hope tells us that there's always something that can be done about the present problem. But the call of realism tells us that the church is not tackling the problem of family head on. What are we saying about the structure of the family that's really going to persuade our individualistic culture? What are we doing to promote real faithfulness and real communication in the home? How well are we planning for the future of the elderly? When former Vice President Quayle made a casual remark about Murphy Brown and the out-of-wedlock baby, he touched on a raw nerve. Can the church answer back and say, we are a place for reasoned, persuasive vision, rather than heat the debate up with knee-jerk reactions? Let's turn to the next category, the church and the city. We all know the astounding facts, but perhaps the reality has not sunk in. At the dawn of our century, only 15% of the world's population lived in cities. It's expected that by the year 2000, That will be 55% or 3.2 billion people. Most of the growth is occurring in the southern hemisphere or in the two-thirds world. By the year 2000, Mexico City and Sao Paulo will be the two largest cities in the world. Of the 10 largest cities in the world, only New York will be in the north. However, the lack of growth in the north is no indication that we'll not be living in an urban culture. Sociologists talk about the rurbanization of America. That is, the transition from rural values to urban values. We are the most highly mobile country in the world. Since 1950, we've bought over 300 million automobiles, and we have built over 43,000 miles of highways. Rural areas have emptied out. People are heading west and grouping in cities. Only 2% of Americans work on a farm. That's down from 44% in the previous century. The traffic jam may become the leading metaphor of our generation. So I was glad we got stuck in the tunnel, Sam. There is, of course, the trend towards the suburbs. The American Home Business Association predicts that by the year 2010, a third to a half of the middle class will no longer live in the city. They'll move to the suburbs and beyond. Yet this does not necessarily mean changing the urban mentality. Today, suburbanization is no longer understood as a haven from the city with its green grass and two-car garages. The suburban sprawl has made the growth of this territory cancerous rather than prosperous. The conglomeration of shopping malls and gas stations has created anxiety, and worse, it has created suburbs without a soul. The growth rate has gone so fast that many suburban units are calling a halt to expansion. The crime rate in the suburbs is actually rising at a greater rate than in the city, at least relatively speaking. Within the reality of these changing patterns, then, one must observe a number of serious threats. The fate of the powerless, the poor, and even the working class is not reassuring. While there is an emptying of the cities by the affluent, the city is not only left with the least privileged people, but it's being filled with immigrants, both legal and illegal. And we can expect more and more ethnic and racial tension because of the great diversity of backgrounds and attitude thrust together. America is not a melting pot, but a salad bowl, as Alvin Toffler has told us. We're no longer a European offshoot with some Africans, but a multiracial world nation. According to Judith Waldrop, you'll know it's the 21st century when everyone belongs to a minority group. How prepared is the church for these developments? Once again, the good news first. The church has in places been creative and effective in reaching urban populations. The Rodney King incident has taught us that where churches have been actively promoting racial reconciliation among minorities, less conflict is likely to occur. This was seen both last year and this in several key cities. This means promoting the placement of minority people in places of authority and responsibility, not just in discussion groups. And when this happens, planning can be done for the future with the key people involved. And the cancerous growth mentioned above can become healthy growth. And that will include civic life and cities and suburbs with souls. A number of remarkable city churches exist with diversified ministries to every level of society. Often that ministry is one of education. There's an encouraging response to church schools sponsored by inner city churches with facilities that would otherwise be empty during the week. Creative ways are being devised to help keep children away from crime. An Episcopal church in Philadelphia has an after-school program for children whose mothers work, where they learn to study, play, and worship in an atmosphere of love and community. Many churches have developed specialized outreaches to the gay community. And despite appearances and rhetoric, most homosexuals are unhappy and guilt-afflicted folks living double lives. Many of them respond to the liberating power of the gospel when it's presented by compassionate staff workers. Such ministries as Harvest and Hope are shining examples of this. A number of churches have also responded well to the salad bowl problem. An increasing number works with various ethnic groups and language culture congregations, that is, churches where a language other than English is spoken. Impressive work is going on in the Hispanic communities. One concern is to provide authentic role models, both male and female, to help children develop healthy images of what family and professional life can be like. It's important for young people to realize that the role models they may pick up from TV, the drug pushers and gang members, are not the only examples to choose from. But now the bad news. In many ways, the church is ill-prepared for urbanization and suburbanization. Elmer Towns has noted that mobility has so changed lifestyle that the church is often behind the culture in making its impact. The newer lifestyles of those who are affluent enough to be mobile often means they have the luxury to isolate themselves in safety and safely sealed off areas where racial integration, concern for the poor, and accountability are eschewed. The emptying of the city's more affluent people means the problem of the people who stay behind is intensified. Ill-equipped to deal with the increasing number of difficulties in the city, the churches are tempted to withdraw or to become sectarian, accepting only people who fit in to the particular culture of their group. Many pastors and staff people are simply burnt out because of the heavy burdens from the troubled people they see day after day. As the city takes its toll on the mental stability and the moral balance of its citizens, the churches are hard put to be an effective antidote. Again, we want to have hope. Nothing is too hard for the Lord. But the church faces redoubtable problems, both in the cities and the suburbs. Are we really addressing the city from a biblical understanding of its nature and its character? Or are many of our programs based on a response to crisis and only that? How far-reaching is our vision? On to the third and final category, the church and our culture. It's impossible to cover such a broad subject as the church and our culture in just a few words. In fact, both the family and the city are a part of culture, so we've already been at it. And just about every other trend that we could mention belongs to culture. And it would be tempting to study some of the cultural currents that have been noticed in the 1990s, like CNN syndrome, New Age fascination, politically correct thinking, victimization, bureaucratic government, and many others. Let me center on two that have particular strength and that have particular consequences for the church. The first is the clash of worldviews. James D. Hunter has written an important book entitled Culture Wars. In it, he describes the clash between two predominant attitudes in America, which he calls orthodox and progressive. The orthodox tend to believe in some kind of absolute, stemming from God or a transcendental principle. The progressives are more relativistic and rationalistic. And these two camps are at war with each other on every front: abortion, censorship, gay rights, education, and politics. Ultimately, according to Hunter, they are struggling over who will occupy the territory. I believe there are such culture wars going on, but I believe there are far more than two camps. It's more likely that there are hundreds of competing worldviews, not just two. We're in a cultural supermarket of diverse views of life. The official word for this is pluralism, or as Oz Guinness puts it, this is the smorgasbord factor. It is the process by which the number of options in the private sphere of modern society rapidly multiplies at all levels, especially at the level of worldviews, faiths, and ideologies. Or as Peter Berger says, it's the trend from fate to choice. Fate because in previous times, many of these decisions were made for us, career choices and so on. Today, choice has become an ultimate reality. Indeed, the ability to multiply our options comes at every level. We no longer marry within the same caste. We no longer choose the careers that our parents chose. We may travel anywhere we like. We may choose any form of entertainment we like. And the great problem for the church in all this is, of course, that it wants to preach one truth in a culture that has largely rejected the idea that truth is exclusive. At best, there may be various languages that say the same thing, using the well-worn image of various paths from the bottom of the mountain that lead to the same summit, but no one truth. Exotic non-Western religions, therapies, and New Age mysticism are far more attractive options than traditional religion. The church also stands for a system of morals that coheres in the character of God. But the surrounding culture finds it more and more difficult to say that one ethical code is right and another is wrong. Tolerance is not only an ideology, but a survival mechanism. Ironically, of course, we see far more anger and frustration than tolerance when it comes down to issues that people really care about. Again, there's good news. Many churches are waking up to the fact that we need to face the clash of worldviews. Many books are coming out which explain Islam, Hinduism, and other philosophies to the Western mind. Many of us are reading the Bible again to discover what it really says about non-Christian religions. Instead of being threatened by diversity, we're learning to rejoice in the good part. God's created order is diverse and rich in its variety. And then to be able to handle the bad part. The deepest differences among people are a constant threat to living in peace and justice together. But we're learning that it is when we stand firmly for what we believe and not when we hide our differences that we can actually get along. I've noticed in my own discussions with people I disagree with, when I'm really sure of what I believe, that's when we have the best dialogue, not when I try to accommodate overly or not when I get angry. It's our ultimate hope to win people of all kinds to the gospel of Christ. We don't want to do it by getting mad, but by gentle persuasion, according to 1 Peter 3. Having said this, there are numerous problems for the church. 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is still the most segregated hour in America. Rather than attempting to understand competing worldviews, we often hide in our tribes. I have a colleague in another theological seminary who also teaches apologetics, Jerome Bars, and he gives an unusual assignment to his first-year students. He tells them to go out and get to know someone who is not a believer. Then present Christianity to him or her in a sympathetic manner. Then you must write a term paper based on that conversation. And then you must show your term paper to your new friend and see what he thinks of it. Jerome says that a good number of students drop out of the course. Some of them out of fear, some of them with the most fantastic theological justification. How are we going to respond to the clash of worldviews? The stakes are high. In a world after the Cold War, we're learning the sad reality of racial conflict that had been kept under the carpet. Ethnic cleansing and cultural blindness has made surface. Will Christians present the shining answer today that St. Augustine presented centuries ago? faced with barbarous and pagan pluralism, he was able to persuade his readers that believing the truth does not make you disdainful of other views. It makes you a better citizen of the city of man because you vindicate the hope in the city of God. The second cultural trend, closely related, is individualism. The term is loose, covers both good and bad connotations. The best face of individualism means becoming more free and more responsible as individuals. The negative side is everyone for himself and lack of concern for community. I think both are at work in our American culture. In their rather overwhelming 400-page study, Megatrends 2000, authors Nesbitt and Aberdeen come to the conclusion that individualism is the single most important trend at the end of our millennium. And they believe that after a century of threats from totalitarianism and mass movements, the individual will become a powerful entity. And they also believe that individualism is not antithetical to community, but makes community possible. Only a responsible individual can live in community, they say. I agree with Nesbitt and Aberdeen that individualism is a trend with some positive features. The church rightly reminds us that each person is responsible and free before God. But I'm not so optimistic as they. I believe modern American individualism is now leading us into more harm than good. We've developed a moral program of it's okay as long as it doesn't hurt anyone else, which is, of course, a terrific illusion. We're more inclined than ever to experiment with secular gods like materialism, narcissism, and hedonism simply because they're available to our individual choice. Individual fulfillment has become the goal of so many in our culture. We've become slaves to the idol of consumerism. Switching relationships is as easy as switching channels on the TV. And most seriously of all, we regard religion as one's private business. We've individualized the truth. Is the church reaching our narcissistic society, or is it tailoring religion to fit the narcissism? Richard Kies, director of LaBrie Fellowship in Massachusetts, believes that the two greatest dangers seducing the modern church are management and therapy. Many churches are turning to management and marketing techniques in order to grow. In this way, people are considered consumers, and the product is religion. The product is sold by turning worship into entertainment and polity into corporate efficiency. Furthermore, many churches are proclaiming a message of self-esteem and recovery rather than sin and grace. The language of therapy covers the sermons, the books, the Christian television programs. Once again, there's much good being done by the church in our individualistic culture. But these twin problems of worldview clash and individualism will need to be faced with all of the wisdom we can muster. We need to go deep down to their root and lay bare their basic claims if we're going to answer with integrity. Now, back to the haunting question. If the numbers in church attendance are the same, and indeed there's religious revival going on in the judgment of some, do we see a significant impact on the family, on the city, and on the culture? And I would say that while many excellent things are going on in these areas, as we've shown, the overall picture is still of grave concern. Of course, as I've said, it's most difficult to measure such a thing as influence, and it's even harder to tell if that influence is in decline. Perhaps what really matters is not tracking progress or decline, but asking the hard question, what is wrong and what should be done about it? Why, if the church is keeping rather a high profile, does it seem to have such a small impact? Or why does it simply not have more of an impact? Why is the church not getting through more than it is? I think that from what I said about these three areas of family, city, and culture, you can guess where I'm going. I believe that while the church has a good deal of vitality, that life is often dissipated and rendered ineffective because of the lack of a radical challenge to our culture's roots from the vantage point of a radical commitment to a biblical worldview. How can it be that in a culture where 94% believe in God, 84% believe Christ is the Son of God, and over one-third claim to be born again or evangelical Christians, so little impact is being made? The major reason is that our faith has become privatized and individualistic. We don't have a comprehensive worldview that allows us to look at the broad realms of culture and family and city and know what our calling is. This is confirmed by the trend in church attendance we noted at the beginning. Though the mainline churches are emptying, newer conservative groups are full. If that's so, why is it that no impact is happening? Is it not possibly because some of these newer groups, while very vital in one way, are quite withdrawn in another way? Many of the newer groups into which believers are going are promoting a privatized faith, which is based on management and therapy. Or, to use George Gallup's devastating expression, American Christianity is broad but not deep. The most obvious example of this is easy to caricature, but it stands for a lot of other things: television evangelism. Christian channels may be viewed by millions, but the message will never have the impact on prevailing culture in that it's meant to have because of its form. The programs usually lack in penetration and vigor. The same is true of Christian publishing. Thousands of Christian books may be selling, but fewer of them are on subjects like apologetics or doctrine. Most of them are on 10 steps to recovery or help with your dysfunctional partner and so on. According to all the surveys, Americans believe in God, but the God they believe in is an affirming, non-judgmental God, a grandfather in the sky who helps them with self-esteem. Americans pray, but we emphasize a laundry list of requests, not praise, worship, or humiliation. According to the surveys, Americans like the Bible a lot. Over 90% considers the Bible a supreme authority, and a good majority of Americans believe the Bible is without error. However, we don't read it, except to get a spiritual jolt. We pick and choose our beliefs, our ways to worship, and then complain that there's no fruit. Of the 19 social values presented in a Gallup survey recently, following God's will is way down the list. The most important are happiness and satisfaction, a sense of accomplishment, and 5 other virtues. So we have the supreme paradox. Americans are more religious than ever before, but faith is increasingly uncoupled from social or cultural consequence. What can be done? I don't want to leave you with this discouraging diagnosis. And I told you there was good news. We don't want to be either happy fools or sad fools. We want realism with hope. And indeed, the Word of God offers us a great deal of realistic hope. But it will have to begin with a serious reassessment of the 2 things that the president of Switzerland had, talking to William, despite his low numbers: a good attitude and a good strategy. This would be the subject of another talk. This one has been too long as it is. Let me just say that fundamentally, I believe we need to close the great gaps that plague today's Christianity. We need to close the gap between feeling and knowledge. Many people have had a religious experience, but few have had the thorough biblical and doctrinal knowledge needed to confront our culture. We also need to close the affiliation gap Many Christians today are skeptical about institutions and practice their faith independently of any church or in churches that are not affiliated. But this is to deprive them of the place the Apostle Paul called the pillar and ground of truth. We also need to close the ethics gap. Fewer than half of Americans agree completely that there are clear standards which never change for judging good and evil. Surveys conducted by the Barna organization show that 3 out of 10 Christians say nothing is more important than having fun and being happy. 2 in 5 say it's all right to do anything as long as it doesn't hurt someone else. In the last analysis, what is needed is a worldview approach to the Christian faith, one that recognizes the radical demands, but also the blessing of God's call and its implication for the family, for the city, and for our culture. We'll need to look at what that means at a structural level. What do we really want to present to America at the end of this millennium? It'll mean a good deal of hard work. It'll mean perhaps being glad to see a few results that are solid as we work quietly and faithfully wherever we are. It may mean the way of the hidden saints who get little glory and press coverage, but are doing far more important work at the hidden level. The many activities we saw in the good news section of this talk are models for what churches can do and do better. But in order to do it better, we need to get down to the principles involved in those activities and not just respond to need. The church will have a crucial role here. So will Christian families, Christian business people, artists, scientists, and so on. We need to say with Abraham Kuyper that there's not a square inch of creation of which Jesus Christ does not say, "It is mine." Or as one friend of mine put it, if you want to be a Christian doctor, then you'll have to do more than put Christianity Today magazine in the waiting room. A few steps are being taken. I've been impressed by the kind of work being done by folks like Oz Guinness with his Trinity Forum, seminars for business people who are challenged with Christian principles beyond the usual appeal to simply be honest. But there'll have to be much, much more if we're going to see significant influence. So in conclusion, can we be realistic with hope? Yes, we can. Not because of clever analysis or trend watching, but because God's infallible word assures us that there is hope. The long term is good, very good. Jesus Christ came to seek and to save the lost. He told us not to fear because he had overcome the world. And his death on the cross avails for every negative trend, for every threat, and for every evil. The short term is not so easy to monitor. What will happen in America as we close out the century? What we do know is that the church will be built and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. What we don't know is whether parts of the American church will be the salt of the earth and the light of the world, whose impact on the family, city, and culture will increase and improve over the next few years, or whether they will lose their saltiness, as the King James puts it. If we ask God's wisdom by faith, knowing that redemption is accomplished in Christ, he will show us the way. And when we have this assurance, then each of us can shoot forward.